think you rewrote the laws of physics, right? Making the world a better place.
What the hell is that?
Big shiny hole in the universe.
Loose threads.
You pull the wrong one, history unravels.
You say that like it's so easy.
Oh no, it's not easy. Not even a little bit.
Welcome to the 12th episode of Zero Hour Strikes, the show that covers DC's 1994 crossover event, Zero Hour, Crisis in Time, every issue, every tie-in, every zero issue. I'm Siskoid.
I'm Bess.
And in this episode, we take a look at Zero Hour number 2, which is confusingly the third issue of Zero Hour as we count down to zero. And when we last covered an issue of the main series, which was just a couple of episodes ago, it wasn't looking good for the JSA, Bess. So this is kind of part 2 of... shafting the JSA.
It really is, because last time it was injury to the JSA. This time it's kind of insult to the JSA. I was like, oh, why are you rubbing it in our faces?
Yeah, not only were they sent to the abattoir, but in this issue, as we'll see, they're also off model. They're acting out of character.
Oh yeah, big time.
Let's just get into it. Rip the Band-Aid off, and do a little synopsis with all the timestamps, which I know you love. Zero Hour number 2 is by Dan Jurgens and Jerry Ordway. Vanishing point, 12 hours, 35 minutes ago. As Dr. Fate's artifacts fall through time, Extant says he combined the powers of Monarch, Hawk and Dove, and Wave Rider to get control of time and destroy it. So he just looks like Wave Rider. He's not Wave Rider. Wave Rider tries to fight him, but Extant refuses to do so because it isn't his time. He also claims he's no nihilist. Okay, so it's a
nihilist.
Neelix. He also claims he's no nihilist. Think about the possibilities that lie beyond the universe's destruction. He sends Wave Rider and the JSA back from where they came from and joins what he calls his armies, super type characters, seen only in shadow here. New York City, 12 hours, 34 minutes ago. A futuristic city is about to fall on Manhattan. The heroes augment Metron's boom tube with their energies to make it big enough to take the floating city back from where it came from. Then the JSA appears, and everyone is sad to find six of them have been killed or are in critical condition. Starman, also wizened by Extant, announces his retirement, and so do Green Lantern Alan Scott and Flash Jay Garrick. Wave Rider tells the remaining heroes that this battle must be fought in the past and the future. New Earth, in the 30th century, 10 hours, 6 minutes ago. Members of the Legion, the Outsiders, and Team Titans, plus Superman, Metron, Wonder Woman, Captain Atom, and Metamorpho, arrive and see time being eaten right in front of them. Before they can do anything, they're attacked by off-model Titans under Extant's control, all culled from alternate timelines. Mirage and Terra are expected to succumb to his will as well. The sanctuary of the immortal Dr. Mist and his layman, 9 hours, 17 minutes ago. Dr. Mist is so old, his timeline is destroyed and he vanishes. New York City, 9 hours, 12 minutes ago. Dr. Midnight dies in the hospital. Flash is pissed off that the Spectre, once a JSAer, was not with them to tip the scales. Still New York City? 8 hours, 22 minutes ago, Power Girl goes into labor and the baby throws up a force field around its mother. Vanishing point, 8 hours, 9 minutes ago, Extant admonishes the Linear Men for being simple observers. Earth's distant past, 10 hours, 6 minutes ago. The other heroes face the wave of total entropy on that end of the time stream. Before they can do anything, they too are attacked by off-brand Team Titans. Extant is with them and fires a temporal blast at Donna Troy, but Kyle Rayner intercepts it and survives. Wave Rider attacks him, and Extant acts like they haven't fought in ages. In fact, from his perspective, this is before the earlier scene, the moment where he steals Wave Rider's powers. The Extant at the vanishing point watches and cheers that this is just as he remembers it. Before he's absorbed by Extant, Wave Rider sends all the heroes back to the present. As the newly powered Extant leaves, a hand takes Alan Scott's ring left on the ground after the battle before it is destroyed by the time wave. It was in Kyle Rayner's possession. New Earth in the 30th century, 8 hours, 9 minutes ago, the heroes have defeated all the Titans. Meanwhile, Metron has calculated that they must make the tear in the fabric of time collapse in on itself by throwing the Mobius chair into the anomaly while Captain Atom fires all he's got into it. It works. Enter the Time Trapper with Rock Kryn, and he sends the heroes back to their century. New York City, 8 hours, 8 minutes ago, Batman, Robin, Batgirl, and Guy Gardner, among others, are fighting more Team Titans. Guy wishes he were better armed, and his armor creates a gun right out of his arm. It's never done that before. The Titans disappear. The heroes who went to the past and future appear. Guy is still thinking about using temporal instability to bring back Hal Jordan and the Corps. Vanishing point, no timestamp. The two extants merge, and he complains his Titans army has all been erased from history, and that his rift in the future shouldn't have been closed, not according to what he saw of the future. New Earth in the 30th century, 7 hours 39 minutes ago, the figure who picked up Alan Scott's ring appears and reopens the rift, and crushes the ring under his foot so as not to be reminded of the universe that will be no more. Next, the end.
It's a beautiful synopsis. Beautiful. There's a lot to unpack on this, in this thing.
In a way, and in another way, it's like nothing happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the heroes did things that didn't really matter. So let's do what we've done each and every time and look at this page to page, sequence to sequence. Let's start with that cover. What do you think of this particular cover? We've got a lot of the heroes. There's obviously that like time wave circle in the middle, but then on the right are today's heroes, and on the left are Team Titans, some of which are recognizable, others are maybe off-modeled, there are too many of them, but it's kind of like swirling in a vortex. That's what I like about it, is that like the heroes are like coming in a wave, like a tsunami on one end, and on the other side it's more like a like scooping down, or but it creates like a vortex image.
It looks like something going down a toilet, but no. It does create that kind of a vortex type thing, and I did dig that. That's pretty nice. Of course, I have no idea who the people in Team Titans are. I know some of them, but not all of them. And you know, I was just looking at the cover, going, I don't know who that is. I don't know who that is. I don't know who that is. That guy looks cool, but I don't know who he is. So yeah, it's in the same type cover that we've seen.
And I've just noticed that all the heroes on the right side are all the young heroes. It's like Titan versus Titan almost. Even though I know the Ray and Anima are not, or Supergirl aren't Titans, but it's like all the young heroes on one side and on the other side, Team Titans or even younger, I guess.
I mean, you really recognize quickly Supergirl, Connor, who is Superboy, and Nightwing. The rest are all, you know, at that time, you know, Kyle Reiner was just introduced recently.
True.
So, I mean, you don't really see him. You can't see the Green Lantern logo. Donna Troy has the Dark Star suit, so we don't really know. We see this new Flash kid who is not Kid Flash. It's Impulse, but
also new.
Yeah, you don't really recognize everybody. I mean, you see the Ray and Nightwing and Superboy, and the rest of them are all unknowns.
All right, let's open this up. The first scene is still in Vanishing Point, and I mean, the important part here is the info dump where the two Wave Riders face off, and one of them is extant, who says he basically stole Wave Rider's powers, as we figure out at some point. Of course, the absurdity here of the Vanishing Point having a timestamp, 12 hours, 36 minutes, Earth time, it says, which is also nonsense because Earth doesn't have a single time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But here it sounds like he defeated Wave Rider in his own, or I mean, in Wave Rider's future, in his past, but in Wave Rider's future, that will happen on page 17. But, you know, the other issue ended and we were like, oh no, is Extant really Wave Rider? But also Extant is also Monarch and is also, you know, is like a time trapper shifting identities thing. But it turns out he's just going to eat Wave Rider.
Basically.
Is this a better reveal or a worse reveal?
It's hard to say. It's more of a deke. It's a fake. It's one of many reveals about this this villain. Right now, I'm just going, what? Is he just absorbing everybody's powers? Why did he absorb the JSA's power? I have mixed emotions.
What do you think of the sequence where the heroes deal with the falling city, the floating city? It's never really established that it would fall.
It's one of those things where you have this huge, dangerous thing that's going to happen, and it's just resolved very quickly.
It kind of has to, because so much of the... I mean, it's like, we got to move on to the next bit, and the next bit, and the next bit. So there's never like the feeling that this is, you know, it's like this story, if it's a story, is just made up of set pieces. So here's a danger, we deal with it. Here's another danger, we deal with it. Here's another danger. And I don't know, it in terms of the writing of it, it's just like these little, I don't want to call them events, because I don't find them all that eventful. But I suppose this is the introduction, I mean, storytelling-wise, it's the introduction of the Mobius chair as a tool that can be used to affect reality in some way.
Yeah, and it can use energy from, you know, different sources, different heroes to transform, to do something bigger than it. Yeah, so it's an introduction to, I guess, the Mobius chair, or if we didn't really know what it was beforehand.
Because it's going to get used again, you know, by the end of the issue. The one thing that bugs me here is, of course, in these crossover events, you've got a lot of heroes who don't normally work together, working together. So there's a little, there's banter, and that's where you can find your little character moments, right?
Yeah.
Theoretically. So here, this is the part that bugs me, is the interaction between Booster Gold and Jo-Na, Ultra Boy, or in this case, Emerald Dragon, as he was known in the late 5 years later era. Here's how it goes. Booster says, hey, green guy, you're from the future. Me too. 25th century, to be exact. And Emerald Dragon says, I know Booster. I'm Emerald Dragon. Believe it or not, I met you before when you first got your Legion Flight Ring. But he was Ultra Boy then. So what is this dialogue? He should be saying, I know Booster. I'm actually Ultra Boy. Remember when we met? But now it's just like Booster Gold must be thinking, who is this doofus?
Who is this guy? I had that little snag also. I was like, all right, so this conversation isn't done, or this is very superficial as far as conversations go. Thing is, we don't see Booster anymore.
In this issue.
In this issue, this is the last time we see Booster Gold. We don't see him at all for the next, rest of this issue.
And Emerald Dragon's going to go back to the future by the end. So to me, that's really rang false. And it's absurd because Dan Jurgens wrote and drew that Booster Gold issue. So he's the writer of Booster Gold. He should know that this conversation makes no sense. So again, I know, I hate to be trashing on the main series here, which seems to be happening more frequently, you know.
Well, that's why we read everything. We don't particularly enjoy the main issues. It's because there's just too much going on. We have little bit pieces of everything that was going on everywhere else. And there's just so much. Everything is just too quick.
You know, that's what's cheating about doing all the tie-ins. And I mean, the cheat in your mind is that when we announced we were going to do Zero Hour, some people were very happy. And then others went, this is a crap series, you know. And then I'm reminded of how they did it on DCOCD, the crossover event show. It did not do well. Invasion did not do well either, you know. And what they do on the show mostly is read the main series. They don't read necessarily all the tie-ins. Some guests might or have a good memory of it. Others don't. But really, they're, you know, very often they're just looking at the main series. And if you only read the main series, or if one of the guests only read the main series, it's going to give low scores to the event because it's incomplete without the tie-ins. And I think in both cases, when we picked Invasion the first time and we picked this one here, what interested me, at least, is that I remembered how great some of the tie-ins were, that this was a bigger event than just the main book. Whereas if we'd done, like, say, Crisis on Infinite Earths, which I also don't think is necessarily a very strong story, you know, the main series has its qualities, but a lot of the tie-ins are just superfluous and don't do much. You know, Red Skies, and that's it, and you still get the banner. Imagine us doing that, and we'd just go, where's the crossover event? Where's the event, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
In the case of both Invasion and this, the stuff, the real meat of it is actually happening in various books. And we could say the same of Millennium, for example. The series is not good, but the tie-ins, you know, have variable quality, but are most, that's where the meat is. That this is where the good stories are, is in the tie-ins. Yeah. With Invasion, it still told a complete story. You know, it wasn't repeating beats. We were seeing things and then, okay, Invasion happens. Then the books react to that. And the next month, the next issue of Invasion, then the books react to that.
Yeah.
In this case, it's all happening simultaneously. So it's like they've got their tentpole events that have to happen that week or in that issue. There's no meat to it. You know, yeah. There's not extra meat where I think Invasion had extra meat.
Yeah, Invasion had a lot of extra meat, actually. Yeah.
It had its story and then everybody grafted their story onto it. This had a concept. Everybody grafted their story to that concept of time anomalies, but yeah. A concept is not a story. And I think this is me working out why these issues are, you know, fall below the threshold of quality for me.
It kind of feels like Zero Hour, at least the main issues. It kind of has Crisis on Infinite Earth envy.
Oh, yeah.
It's trying to be that, and it's trying to have this huge cast of everybody and giving everybody some space and having everybody in there and trying to give everybody a voice. But that only gives us confusion. I mean, the main storyline is what? And we hardly find it in this issue. If it has to, if the main storyline has to happen somewhere, it's in the main issues, right?
Yes. And I think it's like it happens in the beginning and it happens at the end of the series, but there's a lot of filler in this middle here.
Big time. Everybody's meeting everybody for the first time and too many people having too many voices.
At the same time, not that many people, because I like what you said about it being like Crisis or wanting to be Crisis. But I think like it's incredible how much the art style changes the way the storytelling is done. Because in Crisis, you had George Perez. And George can, he could draw dozens and dozens of people in the same splash page. Or he's very good at doing like tiny little panels inset inside a larger structure. And so you could have a cast of hundreds.
Yeah, he's a machine.
And it was perfect for Crisis. Dan Juergens, larger panels, close-ups. It's bigger, but the scale is thus smaller. You know, it's like we've got like fewer panels. The panels are bigger. It's more airy. There's more space in there. This is Crisis. If Crisis had about a tenth of the cast, basically, it's Crisis on a budget. And you know, it's like it feels like okay, the WB was this the WB Crisis, you know, or something because you have fewer characters.
Yeah, it kind of feels like that actually.
Or how the WB Invasion was, you know, like Invasion had tons of characters. But the WB Invasion, when we covered it, it's like, well, it doesn't feel quite as grandiose because there's only one alien species. You know, they're only the characters from the shows. So it's obviously it's smaller. It's on a budget. It's like a downscaled Crisis.
That's where I would have enjoyed that all the tie-ins would have maybe expanded the cast and then everybody had a hand in it. But giving everybody a bigger voice or a better voice, actually. Because the main issues should be only the main, you know, the main characters. In this, who are the main characters? I mean, it's Superman, Metron.
Wave Rider, I guess, who dies here, you know, so, or seems to die anyways. Who's the main characters? The main characters are the characters that have books right now. So that they can do stuff in their books and then they can show up here. And that's the extent of it. You know, it's like, and if you're telling me Wave Rider is the main character because it's a time travel thing or whatever, it's like, well, that's Armageddon 2001. It feels like he's just crashing the party. Like, every so often he crashes the DC universe and there's an event, but there's not much to him.
Exactly. So I think that's basically the frustrations with the main issues in this crossover.
And if we're kind of vamping for time, it's because now we have to address the JSA. I was sort of delaying it because, you know, they show up, they appear out of nowhere. With Wave Rider. Yeah. And then it's like a bit of moaning about, you know, who got hurt and some of them are going to quit. You know, a good opportunity to clearly say what happened to people. To me, it's not very clear. Flash talks in the past tense about Wildcat, but he's still alive. Here's something that I never actually note. I had to go back an issue. Kent and Inza Nelson are apparently alive. Not necessarily alive, but the way he says it, he sounds like they're alive and mortal, disconnected from Dr. Fate. So I went back. And looked at the panel, and when Dr. Fate gets hit, they're split in two.
Oh, wow.
You can see, like, the male-female, Inza and Kent Nelson, are both thrown out. But then there's no bodies for them. they don't bring back their corpses. It's like we've got dead people on our hands, and those. And according to Wikipedia, that was it. They were dead.
They just vanished?
Well, no, but their bodies vanished in the vanishing point or something. They don't get a funeral, I suppose. Were they then crispy fried like the Atom or whatever, and they didn't bring him back? Not clear. And you're doing like big open panels, like we said Dan Juergens does, clarity should be one of the strengths.
I mean, if you're dealing with this type of character, I mean, Dr. Fate, it's a legacy character.
And he's going to send his legacy to a zero issue. We'll see that, the next step. But you want to do something with the original Dr. Fate. You want to give him his due. And it just seems like they got pwned in a tiny panel. And I didn't even notice they got split. So you've got that. You've got, and some people will survive. Dr. Midnight's going to die, but Sandman is just super old. And he'll be seen again, at least in Starman. Wildcat also survives this. Hourman actually survives because later they retcon it to say that this was not Rex Tyler. This was the younger Hourman. Doesn't make sense. But that's how they got out of it when they got to the JSA book, when they wanted those characters back or something. Anyways, kind of get lost in it. But this is the bit where Green Lantern quits the game. And he's still young. He only needs to power up the ring and he's back in action. But no. Here, take my ring, Kyle. There can only be one. He's like speaking what the editor wants him to say. There can only be one Green Lantern, so here's my ring, and screw this.
And it's the voice saying, we are old characters, we should stop, and we're stopping because we're old characters. That was very disappointing, actually. Seeing Jay Garrick rip off the Flash symbol from his shirt, I wasn't really happy about that. I mean, you can quit, but still be proud of what you've done. These guys felt like bitter old men. And that's not what we're supposed to have from heroes.
Basically, they've got the editor's hand up their asses, making them say these things like they're puppets, because it doesn't make sense. Why would a young, vital, he's not young, you know, in his head, I guess, but a vital Green Lantern who's still operating, his ring still works. There's a huge freaking universal cosmic emergency. He was one of the most powerful JSAers, which is why he's still alive.
Yeah.
And he's going to quit on the group. Mm-hmm. That is absurd.
It is absurd. And it's not heroic. It's not what a hero would do. It's not what that particular Green Lantern, what any Green Lantern would do. It's really out of character. I mean, and then we go to page 9, and this is where insult comes to injury. The boxes there say, the torch held by nobility and honor by the first generation has been passed. There is no applause, no words of congratulations. The silence screams respect, but it doesn't. It doesn't scream respect.
Ugh. Even Hawkman is going, part of me wants to quit as well.
Yeah.
What is happening?
This is weird. This is just weird. I mean, it's so out of character, it hurts. I might be controversial here. This is worse than when Wonder Woman snapped Max Lord's neck.
Is it worse?
I mean, it is. I mean, it's not only it's breaking these heroes. I mean, it's basically saying we have no use for you except for your name. I mean, it's horrible.
And nobody tries to talk them out of it. Nobody says a word. It just happens. And it's like, well, they pointed the way. Did they? I mean, Wave Rider has new information. The JSAers weren't needed for this at all. Wave Rider says, and this has not been established in the earlier scenes, but Wave Rider says, we've got to go fight this thing in the past and in the future. Well, he may have come to that conclusion himself, but nothing that we saw previously pointed to that, except that, it's being eaten by both ends. So let's go to each end and try to close it. And then maybe Mobius chair on the one end, and maybe Wave Rider's powers on the other, I guess. So, they get split up. This isn't the end for the JSAers, because they've got another scene to confirm a death later. But, this is fumbling the ball even more. They weren't good in a fight. Now they just fail at their duty, and there's no real feeling or explanation for it. It just happens.
I really didn't enjoy this moment. I really didn't enjoy this. It hurt my feelings deep down. It was, ugh. I don't get emotional for comic books. I was literally going, ugh, what the hell's going on? This hurt me on another level.
Let's go to the future.
Okay.
30th century. So here is that first fight with off-model Team Titans. Terra, or like this other Terra, it's not the traitor Terra, it's the Terra from the Team Titans, and Mirage are in this group. They might fall under the spell. So we knew that Monarch had a hold on them and was controlling them and sent them back into the past in the first place. We sort of knew that because that was decided last minute. it happened at the end of the Team Titans book that we did cover as a sort of prologue. Originally, it was supposed to be Danny Chase, who was also a Titan, controlling things from behind, but behind the scenes. But because the comic had to end earlier, they just went, oh, we have no time to get this wrapped up, so Monarch. And let's just make it part of Zero Hour. So he's also been sort of fostering different timelines, so he has an endless supply of Team Titans. Is what it is. So they're all going to fight instead of closing the rift. You know, they're stuck fighting these guys. And so they're just a distraction, really.
That part I kind of enjoyed in a way that, you know, going to get this huge team from all different timelines, giving you, you know, an infinite number of young superheroes mind controlled. I thought I was kind of cool, but it doesn't make me want to know them. It just makes them basically stormtroopers. You know, they're all superheroes, but nobody cares. They just have powers, but nobody really cares. They're just a bunch of people that shouldn't be doing this. I kind of dug it. I was like, yeah, this, if I was a very powerful super villain, might be something I would do, you know.
It's just something where I wonder what Extant can and cannot do, because he can, I mean, he's absorbing the certain people's powers, but where does mind control come into it? Or, I mean, this is a character that can do almost anything that the storyline needs him to.
Well, that's exactly what it is, right? Even changing identity at last minute. I mean, I think they're cheating with Extent. I mean, that's my feel. I think they're just cheating. He can do anything he needs to do when he has to do it. So here, mind control.
I mean, they established that Mirage and Terra might succumb, but they never do. So mm-hmm. It's another, whatever. Or the other guys prevent them from joining the fray, but whatever. But we'll talk more about them when as the issue progresses. Then we have this odd bit with Dr. Mist, which almost seems pasted on because there's a very thick gutter between that and the rest, and it doesn't really, I mean, it's like when Vandal Savage disappeared. Now it's Dr. Mist's turn, except we know Dr. Mist less.
Yeah.
whatever.
Yeah, really.
Hospital. So this is the JSA's last scene in the issue. We learned that Dr. Midnight, the other guys are, you know, Wildcat and Sandman should make it. They do. But Dr. Midnight could not be saved. And this is where the Flash is kind of pissed at the Spectre for letting them down, just like he and Alan just let down the rest of the heroes.
Yeah, so that kettle is black there.
And it's true. The Spectre is so powerful. He's a problem in all these crises. You know, it's like in the Crisis Infinite Earths, they actually do something with him. You know, he gets giant and he fights the Anti-Monitor. And so that's cool. Yeah. But Invasion, he was like whisked away. And it's there's always a reason why you cannot take part. Yeah. Spectre, says the voice of God. I mean, all this stuff seems to be precursor to another scene later. So same thing with Power Girl and her pregnancy. That's going to be an issue in the Justice League books that we have yet to cover. Here, it's just these are the scenes that don't really fit Zero Hour. They're just there to send you to the other books in case you weren't reading them and maybe you're curious.
These are setups for punches that come in other books.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I'm knocking wood.
A lot of these pages feel like a waste because, I mean, that same page with Power Girl is Extant sort of saying, well, you linear men, all you did with it, with this power and this facility is observe, you dinks. Okay. I mean, it doesn't really add much to the narrative, you know. Did we really need to know that they were still alive? I mean, the linear men, is that the purpose? It just seems like, well, I got a half a page and I don't know what to do with it. To me, that's it. So then we go to the past. And this is another problem that we've identified is that a lot of these locations are just nowhere. We had the Vanishing Point fight last issue where it was just, what did Frank call it? The Windows screensaver circa 1995 or something. You know, it's just like emptiness. The future, which was, you know, floating cities in space. Well, when you look at those sequences, they don't make much use of the environment. You were too close up and we don't see anything of those future cities. In this case, it looks like, I don't know, rocks and water or maybe. Again, the fight happens nowhere and we're so close up that the anomalies in the background are no backgrounds really. And so it's not used in the fight necessarily. Not that we see a whole lot of these fights, but this is the other attack by the other Team Titans in the past. Mm-hmm. One thing I want to ask you about is about Nightwing. Before there's even a fight, they don't even know the Team Titans are there. And they're wondering, oh, how do we close this rift? Donna says, well, Nightwing is our best strategist. I say he's our leader, and he decides what we do. Now, I seem to have heard this discussion before, not about this specific moment. I think it was on the Who's Who podcast, the most recent one, where either in the comments or even in the show itself, but in the comments at least, some people were opining that, and I agree, I agree that Nightwing should be more than just like an older Titan or part of the Batman family. He should be one of the major leaders of the DC universe. When there's a big event, don't turn to Superman, turn to Nightwing. Nightwing should be leading the forces, and that's part of his baggage.
Yeah.
You like that? You like that idea?
Well, I mean, he's been leading teams since he was 12. It's something he does well. I mean, he's been the leader of the Titans since the very beginning. They really looked up to Robin that back in the day for leadership. So he's been leading teams for probably longer than any of them. So yeah, I'm down with that. I'm a big Nightwing fan, so that's great for, you know, my team. I'm Team Nightwing. But I was wondering there, did you see Batman in this issue yet?
Not yet. He stayed in the present. He stayed in the present.
Nobody ever talks to him.
Well, Batman is, I don't think he's a great leader, if outsiders is anything to go by. But my real question here then is, okay, sure, Nightwing should be a leader of this task force. No problem. It's just that this is before, he's a good strategist, she says. And that's great once the Team Titans appear. And maybe you want to coordinate the action. But this is way before, or just before. She's talking about, how do we close a temporal rift? Well, let's ask Nightwing. I don't know about that. I mean, strategy aside, this is not a strategic... It's not a problem of tactics.
No, you know what? I think this is where storytelling kind of gets... Well, I mean, it's messed up in the entire issue. So I think here, this wasn't really well mapped out. And
At all.
Nightwing would be great to close doors and windows and fight other teams. But, you know, closing temporal rifts, you go to a cosmic superhero.
Well, in this case, you ask Wave Rider.
Yeah, Wave Rider.
And this is my problem with the event, if it had been better planned out, where are the physicists? You know, if this were the Marvel Universe, you'd expect Iron Man on one team, Mr. Fantastic on the other team, you know, stuff like that. Here, where are the physicists? Where are the Brainiacs? Where's Brainiac 5? Who do we need to bring to the present for no reason so then we can bring him back to the future anyway? Lightning Lad, you know, yeah, that's gonna... And the teenage Lightning Lad at that. You know, it's like, where are the brains that we need to fix this thing? They don't exist.
Well, I think they were really focusing on Brawn. We don't see a lot of brains in this issue. No. Or any issue, actually.
Even behind the issue. So, of course, here the Team Titans are with Extant. And Extant zaps Kyle Rayner, who saves Donna Troy. And they're going to have a relationship later. That's interesting. And this is where Extant, who is still Hank Hall, eats Wave Rider. And then at the end of that... Wave Rider just sends the group back home without closing the anomaly. This trip was for nothing. And then we see at the very end, Wave Rider disappears. And just before that time period disappears, a hand picks up Green Lantern's ring, Alan Scott's ring, which had been given to Kyle as a passing of the torch. And Kyle just had it like loose in his hand or something. Yeah. So he's got very tiny fingers. It just slipped off. I don't know. But it wasn't powered anyway. But somebody picks it up and then we're supposed to go, who could that be? Now, of course, we know. And it's going to become more and more. Let's wait to the end of the issue to even discuss if we want to spoil it for people.
Okay. Okay, cool.
But this is another instance of this is like the most continuous fight. It's like a good 4 or 5 pages in the past.
Yeah.
Unbroken. Yeah. And nothing really happens. You know, I mean, Wave Rider gets killed and all of that, but they don't, the heroes with, you know, despite all of Nightwing's tactics.
They don't make any progress with the main story.
So that's what that is. And then we return to the future and the fight's over. I love how Superman's finishing it off by hitting Battalion, elbowing Battalion in the face. I like that visual. It's like he's not even looking. And that was the end of it. You know, so we missed that fight.
Yeah.
They do manage to close that gap. Basically, all they needed was Captain Atom and Metron, plus others to fight the fight. And then, of course, the Legionnaires and the Time Trapper, and that's the Time Trapper who sends them back because now they're missing the chair. So Metron has no chair for the rest of this event because he used it to close it up. Would you believe, okay, like Mirage and Terra, who got prevented from flipping, we'll see them again in Zero Hour because they're still with the heroes. But would you believe this is the last appearance of Team Titans?
So he has this incredible army of young superheroes that we never see.
I just don't mean the army. I mean the guys who had a comic are wiped from history basically at this point. I mean, some shades of them may reappear and as you reconfigure continuity, right? But that was it for them. This was their last appearance. Team Titans were gone. Talk about the JSA not getting any respect. This is how this team goes out.
Oh, that's horrible. These few pages are so chaotic. Everything is just all over the place. I didn't even realize that this was the end for this team.
Nobody mentions it or anything.
At all. This is a mess up of a story.
Because then we're back to the present, right? Everybody gets sent back.
We go back to the present. And what happened, actually? Where?
Well, they're also fighting some Team Titans. It's not very clear because the two characters that we do see getting punched by Batman and Robin. One of them might be like an alternate version of Mirage, maybe. I don't know who the other guy's supposed to be. So they're not like...
And a blue guy.
Yeah, I don't know. There's like, who are these guys? If they were more, you know, more obvious Team Titans. But they do say that's what these guys claim they're the Team Titans. And this is Batman's only appearance, right? Like, only other appearance is like we see him punching a guy. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that bit with Guy Gardner, who can make weapons out of his armor. Well, I guess we'll get to talk about that when we cover the Guy Gardner Warrior issue. But this is also another like non sequitur. Please read the series for more.
There's so much of these. We have people phasing in and out. I mean, we see the Titans or the Team Titans disappearing, and then one panel later, the heroes appearing. Everything is within a void also, so it's kind of weird knowing where you are.
Thank God for the timestamps.
Yeah, really. It's confusing, not very well written. The continuity within the scenes is difficult to manage. I mean, it's a hard read. It's a hard read.
Basically, it ends with Extant. Extant absorbs himself, which means there is no version of Extant who really fought the JSA and killed the JSA because he eats his past self before he gets there, I guess. Yeah. So
the old Extant never existed.
It's a paradox, but it's not necessary. There's no reason for past Extant to go talk to future Extant and then get absorbed. Really, he should be moving over and becoming future Extant. He should have moved from that fight to the JSA fight. And then there's no two Extants. There's no reason for two Extants. Anyway. And then back to the 30th century, where basically the only thing that we knew was done was that the rift had been closed in the future.
Yeah.
Our one victory. Somebody appears in a green glow, and that same person has the Alan Scott's ring. And that person, with a wave of their hand, basically restarts the rift. Destroys the ring, that to say, that's it. No more Green Lantern from the past either. We've destroyed that ring. Easily, even. Like, it was, like, made of something very easy to shatter. So whoever this super powerful being is has just undone the one thing the issue managed, the one positive thing the issue managed. Even the negative things that happened. I mean, is Wave Rider really dead? You know, as a temporal being, who knows? Dr. Midnight was essentially dead in the other issue, and now it's confirmed that he's dead. And then the JSA quits after they really made a point of just decimating the team. Whatever they make happen was really a done deal last time. And the things that they do in this issue is just like one step forward, two steps back.
They're just reconfirming everything from the JSA. And, you know, they take one step forward and they basically erase it. Why was this issue here?
Why was this 5 issues?
Yeah, really.
There's at least one issue that has no... I mean, it was 5 issues probably because it was a 5-week month. And it was a weekly, and it all happened in 1 month. And then we had 0 month the next month. So it's the only reason it is this length. Because the other series don't weave in and out of this. It's like all happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it could have been 4 weeks. I'm sorry, guys, that we are being negative and kind of downers.
This wasn't our intent. I mean, we love these comic books and we love the characters and we love everything. But this is a bit of a dumpster fire. If this comic was something, it would be 2020. I mean, this comic is not going anywhere. Maybe the next ones will be better. I don't know.
But it's the middle, right? So it's like there were 2 issues before and there are 2 issues after. So the middle is... just gristle. There's just nothing to it. There's no, it has no nutritional value in the sandwich, basically.
No. This is lettuce.
Why would you put the lettuce in the middle, in the exact middle?
I don't know.
It makes no sense.
They did it. Yeah. I know.
So hopefully the penultimate and ultimate chapters will be better. And I think they will be. Mm-hmm. We'll have to tangle with this new villain that appears at the end here, who will turn out to be the true villain of the piece. Because, after... you know, on issue 4, let's introduce the actual villain. Oh, come on. We're so invested in Extant.
I know. We like the color scheme. Black and red. It's so powerful.
Well, stand by for some green instead, because obviously there is a Green Lantern connection. It's pretty obvious this is going to be.
It's pretty obvious. Okay,
we'll take a short break now. When we return, your feedback on our previous episode, and we'll get to talk about stuff we actually liked, maybe.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
Because you demanded it. It's Treasury Cast, a podcast devoted to the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. DC, Marvel, Archie, IDW, and more, bigger than life. It's the Treasury Cast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Letters Lost in Time.
Letters Lost in Time.
Our coverage of Adventures of Superman 516 and Steel No. 8 generated some comments. Michael Bailey never thought the Alpha Centurion ever quite hit the heights of Gangbuster for him, but he liked the character well enough. He served more as a fly in the ointment. He eventually started working with the Contessa Erica Alexandra Del Portenza, who took over LexCorp shortly before Lex returned around Underworld Unleashed, married Lex, had his kid, etc., and turned Team Luthor into the Centurions. As for Steel, he says, I love John Henry Irons as a character. The fact that this book didn't have a zero-hour banner across the top combined with me not paying attention to solicits, like I eventually did, meant that I started picking up Steel much later than I did Superboy. His first 2 years of comics were rough, like Simonson had an idea but didn't execute it well. The various artists that worked on the books, the best being Batista, leaned hard into the early 90s tropes, just as the rest of the DCU did in that 2 years after Zero Hour, until everyone woke up with a hangover in 1996 and said, wait, we don't have to do this. I like John's family, especially Natasha, who went on to become a great hero on her own. Eventually, Christopher Priest and Dennis Cohen took over the book and gave John a new set of armor with a modified S and the book came alive. Too little, too late, it seems, because it didn't last long after that. Morrison brought him into the JLA, and his moment to shine was during DC 1 Million, where the main heroes were off in the future, so Steel, Big Barda, and Huntress took on the Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman roles. And it was one of the better parts of the event. In the 2000s, John created Steelworks and started building non-lethal tech for the SCU, in addition to being part of Team Superman. Things got murky towards 2002, and the character was off the table for a good long while. He popped up here and there. Steel was part of the Reign of the Doomsdays story that closed out Superman before Flashpoint. And he was right at the beginning in Morrison's Action Comics and eventually began dating Lana Lang. But it wasn't the same. Steel deserved better, but I am glad I got as much of him as I did. So this sort of answers the question as to how much did they use Steel? And, yeah, you know, if you didn't read some of the comics, you felt like, well, they sort of abandoned Steel. That was our feeling, you know.
I had no idea, really.
Chris Franklin says, I liked Steel a lot in Reign of the Superman and was excited for his solo series, but yeah, it just didn't sing. Not sure why. I agree Bogdanov coming over to this title like Grummet did with Superboy would have helped, although I like Batista's work here just fine. I didn't like his new armor as well until a few years later, Kenner Hasbro released a figure of this version that was all chromed up and vac metalized. Not really a word, but toy folks use it. That is one sharp-looking figure and retroactively sold me on this particular armor. I had never really considered that John Henry should be DC's go-to black tech hero in the Justice League instead of Cyborg, but damn it, you're right. He works well in that capacity in the comics and in JLU, which Chris will get to shortly on JLUcast. I honestly think that the stink from the Shaq movie has damaged the character. Hopefully, it's been long enough that we may get to see him move past that in other media. Now, Chris isn't the only one to throw shade at the Shaq movie. There are others, like Lizanne Oswald, telling us not to watch it. Well, we're very contrary, so we did watch it.
We did.
I liked it.
I liked it, too.
Yeah, no.
I thought it was better than half the Batman movies.
Obviously, it has the feeling of a made-for-TV production, you know.
Yeah, and it has issues. It's not the Steel movie we should have had, but it wasn't that bad.
No, I mean, if you take it like it was a Steel pilot for a TV show, it is directed by the guy, like someone who worked on Incredible Hulk, who gave us V, and who gave us Alien Nation. Feels like an Alien Nation script, quite frankly, with the souped-up guns. Instead of being stolen from the military or whatever, might have been stolen from the aliens. You know, it is that kind of crime story. I mean, Shaq is not a good actor. That's not what we're saying.
Shaq is not a good actor. It never was. Never will be.
No.
He's actually fun in this movie.
And I like his relationship to, I mean, this is a superhero movie where a mostly black cast on the hero side, and the one that isn't is a disabled woman. They're going to save the town, you know, the city from these souped up gangs and guns. I mean, it's basically what the Steel series did with the more street level stuff, but also the armor is more street level.
The Steel movie wasn't a armored guy in a Superman type thing. You know, he's not looking up to Superman in this. Superman has nothing to do with Steel in this
movie. He's
got
the tattoo. Yeah, he has the Man of Steel tattoo. Superman exists.
But Superman wasn't the superhero that was popular at this time. It was Batman. And it really feels like, you know, armored Batman type movie. There's no big cape. He doesn't fly. He's doing stuff on the street level. Even his cousin says, I'm like, I could be like your Robin to your Batman. You know, they just like laugh it off. They make a lot of references to being like Batman or the Batman family. I mean, even the lady in the wheelchair, she's basically Oracle.
Yeah, he's got an Oracle. He's got an Alfred, who was played by Richard Roundtree, was Shaft. There's also a Shaft joke, some basketball jokes, and yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of funny stuff. I mean, I love the Shaft joke. I love the Shaq can't throw a free throw joke. I loved it. I just think that Shaq was a bad choice because he's too recognizable. I mean, he's 7'3".
There's no secret identity here, no.
There's no secret identity. You can't hide him. But, I mean, everything else was, the effects were pretty good. The villain had a weird motive, but, I mean, it kind of worked. I thought it was fun. I thought it was more fun than good, but I did really enjoy it.
I agree. I'm not going to say this is top tier superhero stuff, but it's not grimdark. It's not depressing. It's not objectionable in the way that some of the DC movies have been in terms of ethics and, you know, like superhero morals.
Yeah, you know, it was better than Green Lantern. I mean,
you're probably right. I think you're probably right. We don't even need to go into the Snyderverse or not. You know, it's like, yeah, it's probably better than, I mean, for what it is.
I think it was good enough that we should be maybe thinking about doing another Steel movie. But this time have a Steel who is closer to Superman than Batman in style and in color. I mean, because he is a hopeful hero on the street level. And he has a great cast. I'd love to see a Cyborg Steel team up. If we're going to have techno superheroes, these guys would wreck. But I think we should be thinking about a Steel movie, honestly, with a great actor, not Chad, but a great actor. Budget. He is the DC Universe's Iron Man.
And now that Iron Man is sort of retired, you know, from the movies, it kind of opens the door for that kind of action. But he's also a very different character in terms of personality. So I think we can have characters that have a similar power set. There are plenty. If we can have a Shazam and a Superman, they're just like tonally different. Yeah. Personalities different. Kind of stories are different. Then, of course, we can have a Steel and an Iron Man and a Cyborg, all having their own movies or, you know, and in some cases, maybe sharing a movie. Maybe not take it so seriously, and if you get a chance to watch that Steel movie again, it's perffectly pleasant. It's not great movie making, but it's also, you know, it's kind of felt like, it's like a low budget Fast and Furious kind of feel. You know, it's kind of about family. Yeah, yeah. I think the jokes land, and there are some things that don't really work or make sense, but obviously I want Steel flying around. I don't want Steel running around using bat rope to go up buildings. Exactly. But that's all they had to work with at the time. It was not possible to make him fly.
I would have liked the hammer to be used as a hammer.
As a gun.
But, you know, because it was just used as a gun. But, I mean, everything was military and everything was... It was a fun movie and it was enjoyable.
I mean, even the romance element in this was actually platonic. It was about two friends who loved each other. You know, it's like, it felt really sweet. So... Maybe people don't trust us, but I say
nor they should.
It's time for a revisit and a reevaluation with the perspective that it is. I mean, we have friends who watched the JLI pilot, you know, and it's better than that, for sure.
It is big time.
All right, what else do we have here? David A. Gutierrez asks, "Who does Bass hate more, Sanagarians or men with long hair?" You made some disparaging comments about Superman's do. So which is it, Bess?
You know what? I prefer a man with long hair than a Thanagarian with short hair.
Okay. There you go. On the question of whether the cover is correct, putting an apostrophe S after Metropolis, the Metropolises, Clinton Robinson flaunts his multiple English degrees and says it is correct. Fine. Ange was more of an Eradicator guy than a Steel guy in The Reign of the Superman, but was thrilled he got his own book. He says, I like how he was a family man in this crazy DCU. And like John, I look up to Superman, so I like that he remained a part of the Superman family. After giving a complete history of his interactions with Adventures of Superman, Frank says, Alpha Centurion definitely looked better in his later Imonen drawn costume. I never really got his whole deal, so I'm glad this episode helped clear up that he's basically Terra Man with tzatziki sauce. As for Steel, he says he was immediately and easily my favorite of the Reign of the Superman. A popular theory at the time was that each of the Supermen had some aspect of the real Steel deal, with the Eradicator seeming to be the body, Cyborg the mind, and John Henry Irons the soul. The Metropolis Kid was the stain on the mattress. In the years since, I've made the argument that Steel is actually an amalgamation of the big three Avengers. He's got the armor and advanced tech of Iron Man, the physical dimensions, cape, and flung returning hammer of Thor, and the manner, heart, and brawling tendencies of Captain America. I still love this character and have several of his action figures. It's a good point.
Oh, yeah. It is a very good point.
He goes on.
I love
it. He says,
that.
I made it 5 issues into his solo ongoing before bowing out on account of it being awful. The 2 main problems were that Louise Simonson shouldn't have written it and Chris Bautista shouldn't have drawn it. The primary appeal of Steel was that despite John Bogdanov being a white dude, his art was Afrocentric. His caricatures felt authentically urban and a sort of Milestone's take on a Superman satellite was novel. But Milestone already had hardware in his own series 4 months before Steel had been introduced, with a fully legitimate approach to an African-American Iron Man written and drawn by notable black creators. Even if Simonson wasn't reading hardware, she trod so closely to the same storytelling territory with a more comfortably passive protagonist as to read like whitewashed plagiarism. Also, frankly, Simonson was borrowing heavily from black-oriented media of the time, and there's only so much mileage you can get out of reskinning Boys in the Hood. This even before you factor in an aging white lady trying to speak to an alien experience that McDuffie and Cohen were intimately familiar with on a book out by the same company at the same time. So we had Steel and Hardware, and then one was legit, the other one wasn't, basically. Meanwhile, Batista's work was in no way Afrocentric and was trading on imagery of violent thugs barely removed from a Charles Bronson movie. Obvious good intentions aside, it read like corporate appropriation with an unintentional right-wing strain of respectability politics. Steel was one of the good ones, protecting white society from the bad ones. Even setting aside the miserable optics, it was obvious that no one involved knew what to do with Steel. It was a street book, so there was a lot of obligatory gangbanging between anonymous men wearing do-rags over their dreads, differentiated by Toastmasters and the super steroid Tar as weapon of choice. There was that one yawn of a rejected Man of Steel outer space arc with Maxima. Then the vastly inferior Phil Gozier took over the art, and 3 years of publishing were eked out pretty much solely by Superman family completists. As a person who cared about Steel and DC Comics running a shop throughout these years and getting into long conversations with usually non-white customers about characters like Steel, I can tell you with some specialty knowledge that nobody liked this book then or now. It sucks. It is objectively worthless and undesirable to read. No continuity even escapes its pages. And then 2 black creators that helped draft the story bible for Milestone took over and made it probably the best book DC was publishing in that last year. He's talking about Cohen and Priest. So I'm thinking, you know, we're talking, well, maybe we should reread Steel or find those Steel issues. But really, the gem here seems to be that last year. That passed me by. I did not see those issues. I was either not reading Steel anymore or I dropped out of comics entirely, which I did in the late 90s for a while there.
Yeah.
So those are the issues that sort of intrigue me because everybody's kind of waxing that late tier car.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I probably will grab, you know, these issues and just to, you know, sometimes contrast makes things better. If I just read the good books, I'm going to think everything was good. So I'm going to grab some of the early books. And he does bring up a good point of doing this black comic book coming from white people, just trying to make a white point of it. So I'd really like to see both of them because we're right now we're in this time where we're getting to, I think, trying to understand everybody culturally. And I really love to see that contrast because I think it's important to see it. Not because I want to enjoy the first ones. I just like to celebrate the later ones at that point.
Tim Price raises questions about Alpha Centurion's timeline. He asks, has he taken over the police or security of Metropolis with 911 being replaced by 100, which took me too long to realize it refers to Century? I didn't even notice that. Is AC secretly ruthless, like Lex Luthor, since he can afford that building? How does he treat women, what with having handmaidens catering to him? Why doesn't this bother Lois, a staunch feminist in mainline DC? Does his hot tub of healing slow or stop aging? There's so much to explore, and one issue doesn't scratch the surface. I even suspect Kiesel didn't have his full story figured out, but just threw a lot of ideas there, as he usually does, and it almost makes it too interesting, because no follow-up is ultimately disappointing. Still, It made for a fun what-if or imaginary tale issue.
I agree. There's so much to explore with Alpha Centauri.
He needs his own Earth. And on that note, we have to mention that the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. So if you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Get on the zero list at patreon.com/FWPodcast, just like these fine folks did. They got on the zero list, and that means they're going to escape the cataclysmic time wave that's coming from both ends of history. Jim Ball has been saved from before Oa split the universe in two. David Capoon has been saved from contemporary Gotham just as he was about to get mugged. So, you know, it's like double save. And Michael Bailey been saved from Abracadabra's century. Apparently the magic shows are pretty bad. That's what he escaped from. A reminder that you can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also follow Fire and Water's Facebook page or on Twitter. The account is FW Podcasts. So that's it, Bass. Next time we get back into the tie-ins.
Good, good. I'm looking forward to seeing some stories. Next time on 0 Hour Strikes, Legion 94 number 6970 and Outsiders number 11.